I've seen I've managed to wipe out about half of you. Well, that's not bad. Thank you for coming again. So what I'm trying to, I'm not trying to define problems for you. What I'm trying to do is give you a little background for next week. Because in my first talk on Monday morning, I will try and define the problems that physicists might think. So at the moment, I'm just trying to give you a bit of background. And if you can remember, I just want to remember this is where we ended. And this is one of the big problems about gradients. The way the wing disk of the fly is patterned, a gradient in this particular molecule is set up like this, a mirror image, and then a particular threshold, various genes are turned on. And what I will say on Monday morning is how in the hell do you get this gradient to be reliable? And how in the hell do you actually interpret it reliably? But we'll talk more about that on Monday morning. Now, let me get here now. So what I want to move on to do, I've got to say slideshow. Slideshow, sorry kids. Show slide, oh gosh, I've got to go through view show. So I'm going to have to just clickety-click very quickly.
So this gives us a quick review.
Don't blink, kid. Come on. We're nearly there. There we are.
Are you willing to go back one or two?
Of course.
And then start there?
No, I don't want to.
You don't want to just go back. Yeah, take a thing
and... How in the hell have I got onto motor neuron here? That's the one that I just showed, isn't it?
Yes. Can we see the one before this?
Sure. Yes, you saw it, but you don't want to see that. And I was going to tell you about neuron specification. Well, just to tell you, I make it very brief because I'm not talking much about the nervous system, but just to say that the same principles of graded things determine your movements are controlled by motor neurons that come from the spinal cord. And the work of Tom Jessel, here's the spinal cord, here's the early limb bud, and here the motor neurons are going in. And each neuron is specified. I'm not going to tell you. They have various genes turned on in them. So the ones that go to the back muscles have these genes. Those that go to these muscles here have these genes. And those that go to the dorsal ones have these genes. How do they get turned on in the right nerves at the right place? And once again, it's partly gradients. And I'm not going to take you through this in detail. But just have a look here, that in the spinal cord, there's Sonic Hedgehog again. Remember Sonic Hedgehog from the limb? It's graded. And then all these things are present in various forms. And the combinatorial nature of these things determines the nature of the motor neurons. Is it working now? No, it doesn't.
No,
it doesn't. I'll use the stick. It's fine. So I just want to say, the same principles, effectively, that pattern the wing of the insect. Please. Sorry? No. This is a transverse section. I'm so sorry. This is a transverse section of a spinal cord. It's not a gradient going. I'm going to come to this movement in a moment. This one's a transverse section. And motor neurons... I'll get back one. Sorry. Motor neurons are formed in this part of the spinal cord, not in the thing. So that's a transverse section. Okay? So I just want to say it's the same principles, right? And then what you're going to hear quite a lot about next week is from Eric Davidson, who's going to talk about the sea urchin, I'm almost certain. I don't want to get you too involved in the sea urchin, but the sea urchin egg divides and you have all these cells and they give rise to all sorts of things. Then they give rise to a larva, and that's the gut, and that's the apical tuft, and these are the mesenchyme cells that lay down the skeleton. Now, what Davidson has examined in enormous detail, and he will undoubtedly tell you about it, is a particular gene called endo16. And endo16 in the early embryo is expressed in this part, yes, and later on it's expressed in the gut. And if you look at the control region for that gene, it's a nightmare. Well, at least I think it's a nightmare. There's a G region which acts on other regulatory regions. There's an F and E region. Now that shuts off expression in other regions to make sure it's in this region here. Then there's D and C, that it shuts off in expression in the most ventral region. And then there's B that makes sure that it's expressed in the midgut. And if you think that's complicated, that's a diagram of the control region. The actual control region looks, oh damn it, I meant to put it on here and I haven't. Sorry, I'll show it to you on Monday morning. It's hideous, just believe me. Many, many proteins, many, many binding sites. Sorry, I thought I'd put it on here. I haven't. I'll show it to you Monday morning. Okay, so I just want to say that, once again, I'm emphasizing that the cis-regulatory region is crucial. And now what I want to tell you about is the main body plan. Why your neck vertebrae or your neck vertebrae are different from those in your body. And if you remember, you don't remember, but along the body of the insect, these HOX genes are turned on. And in you, I think I've got them there. And if you change these HOX genes, you can get different animals. So, for example, that looks like a Daphnia and that looks like a locust. Yes? And if you look where the HOX genes, these are all HOX genes, you can see the same HOX genes more or less are expressed in both, but in different regions, and that's why these animals have different forms.
So the colors correspond.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, yes.
Very strange, isn't it?
No, they're very different animals.
No, why is the first one in stripes?
Because it's expressing both ultrabithorax and abdominal A.
So in the locus, there's only one red region.
Yeah, that's
there's
right.
Many red.
Yes. Yes, you're absolutely right.
And it goes across the different legs?
Yes,
the
apparently.
Top thing.
Yes.
What is the top thing? Some kind of worm?
Daphnia, it looks like to me. Shrimp.
Some shrimp.
Shrimpy.
But it goes across the legs?
Yes. Agreed. It's expressing all those genes. Complicated, yes. But this one here, only in this region here, and that's why those legs are different to these legs. And it's the downstream targets. Just remember, the real problem is downstream. Sorry, you want to? Please ask.
The confusion is, are they expressed in stripes?
No. Oh, no, sorry. No. Please, no. Sorry.
So what it means is
that those three classes of genes, all three are expressed in those regions. Yes. Sorry.
Oh, that's what you
I'm so sorry.
Oh, okay. That was what I was wondering.
Good Lord, no. Sorry, I'm sorry. Okay. Now, In your ancestor, that's the hypothetical common ancestor. Here's the Drosophila HOX gene, and this is yours. The gene duplication is fundamental to evolution, because the virtue of a gene duplicating is that you've got two of the same, and one can go off and do something else, and you've still got the original. So gene duplication thing, and here you've got, instead of having just the one set, you've got four sets, and there are various ones there. And if you actually look how those are expressed, well, you have to understand a tiny bit of embryology. I'm terribly sorry. This is the chick embryo. And your development, the chick embryo is nice and flat, the way it develops, believe me. If you take the chick embryo and you scrunch it all up, that's what you looked like as an embryo. And the mouse too, it's horrible. I can show you pictures, you'll never understand them. I don't understand them. It's all rearranged, yuck. So what happens is very early in your development, something called the primitive streak develops, and this is one of the things that Michelle and I are working on, that morphogenesis. And then there's a special signaling region at the top here called Henson's node. It then begins to move backwards, and as it moves backwards, somites, blocks of tissue appear. And all your vertebrae and the muscles for your limbs come from these somites. Okay? So there's a strange performance. You go forward, the signaling region moves back. I'll show you a signaling thing. And as it moves back, it leaves behind the trail of somites. And also, it's during that process that HOX genes are specified. So the anterior HOX genes will be expressed up here, and the posterior ones down there. If we go back, I can show it to you in the next slide in a moment. Just to show you that this really is a signaling region, if you take the signaling region and put it in another chick embryo, you'll get another axis. And here, in fact, are the somites again. So it's a genuine signaling region. It's an organizer. It's called an organizer. It's quite impressive, goes back a long way. And by the way, that's what it begins to look like. Here's the neural tube that's going to give rise to your nervous system, and here are the somites that are going to give rise to the vertebrae and muscle and your dermis and things like that. And from a very early stage, the cells know what they're going to do. So here this is regressing, but if you take cells from here and put it into a younger embryo here, then what you see is you get ribs in the neck. So already at this stage, even before the somites have formed, these cells know aren't going to be ribs. And you put them somewhere else, they're going to make ribs. That's the sort of thing. And so what we want to know, a crucial issue, is how in the hell do the cells know their positional identity along there? And I'm afraid it's just like the insect, it's the Hox genes, of course. And just let me show you one particular pattern of Hox genes. So this is the HoxB complex. B1 is at the end, this end of the chromosome, B9 at that end. And look where they're expressed. HoxB1, that one is expressed near the head. HoxB4 is further back, and HoxB9 is even further back. So the order along the chromosomes is also related to their position along the body. Please.
Why?
Why is it? Are you asking me or evolution or you mean?
Well, your take on it.
Well, I'm going to tell you how. Like, why is that you... The essence of development is cells have got to become different to know where they are. Okay? And that's what the Hox genes do. They tell the cells where they are. Now, how they do that, I'm going to tell you in a moment, please. Sorry?
The somites form in the same mechanism, or is
that... Oh, every somite forms by the same mechanism. Somite formation is a story in itself where I'm not going to go into. But Michelle and I have a model, and I'm not going to tell you. It's a little controversial, but I'm going to tell you a little bit about somite formation now. And what you have now along the axis, if you just look at any place, for example, in the neck region, you have these Hox genes on. In the thorax, these, and so forth. So there's, you can think of almost a combinatorial code at any level along the body of what Hox genes are on, and that determines. Now, just let me tell you, before I tell you anything else, you may ask, and you would be right to ask, what are the downstream targets of the Hox genes? We know some. How many, we do not know. So how they actually exert their effect and make one kind of it still to be worth.
Is this picture the same for all vertebrae?
Pretty well. Oh, pretty well.
The number of genes, Hox genes?
Yes, pretty well. A little bit varied, but nothing interesting. Oh, the zebrafish has got an extra set of Hox genes, they double. But basically this is.
Does that mean they all have a common
ancestor? Have a? Of course we've got a common ancestor. Good Lord. I'm a creationist, but I'm not. And this is, for example, why they're called Hox genes. Here's the mutation in whatever, I've forgotten which mutation. Oh, HoxC8 is deleted, okay? And so you get an extra pair of, these are the sort of experiments. And there are millions of mutations, you knock out one Hox gene. That's a homeotic mutation because you, in one place you get a structure that shouldn't be there. And there are millions of experiments like that. Not easily interpreted, by the way. And here we come to probably one of the most interesting events in recent developmental biology. How do you put the Hox genes in the right place, and how do you make somites? You get these segmental structures. You see, you've got these somites coming here. Remember I told you, here's the regressing node. Then there's a region where they're already specified, and then the somites form these very regular blocks. And in the chick, I think they form every 90 minutes, I can't remember. You get a somite every 90 minutes. And the great discovery recently is that there's a gene called HER1, doesn't matter, originally found in Drosophila, which oscillates. It has a 90-minute oscillation. It goes up, then it goes down, the messenger RNA. And so what you have, just let's get clear what's here. Here are the differentiated somites. This is moving backwards. There's a stem cell population in here, and as this moves back, cells get left behind. And so here's the pre-Semitic mesoderm, and this shows you the oscillation of the hair. It goes up, then it goes down, goes further down, then it comes up again. So it's oscillating throughout this region, okay? And if you have a look, what are we going here? So this is how the thing progresses. Every 90 minutes, you get another somite formed. Okay. So what's the mechanism? It's obvious. It's a progress zone. Look, please, you have to take everything I say with a slight pinch of salt, because I'm telling you, I'm not telling you all the controversies in the field. No, but it's a general, and the people who put this down, the basic idea is this, that the cells in this stem cell region here are undergoing oscillations. And they count how many oscillations in some way, we have not the foggiest notion how. And as they leave, yes, that determines how long they've been in there, determines which of the Hox genes come on when they've left. And if you remember, the order of the Hox genes along the chromosome is the same as the order in which they're specified along the body. And there's some time, it's complex. Denis de Boulle from Switzerland writes very complicated genetic, brilliant genetic papers. It's hard to understand, but that's, what's the German for one street? Einbahn, exactly, well that's Denis. What's Denis? Denis has this joke about one-way traffic, you know, and he goes one way. You've got to, something like that, anyhow. So the basic idea is, the order of the genes along the chromosomes, together with the time in the zone before they come out, determines what gene will be turned on. Therefore, at the anterior end, it's the ones at the end of the chromosome, at the very posterior, the other end of the chromosome. And that's what tells your head, no, not your head, at least your neck from your bottom. Okay. Now, just while we're here, it's just worth noticing, and I can't resist telling you a tiny little bit, is that many of us are very involved in left-right asymmetry. I don't think you'll hear much about it at this meeting, but it's such a lovely problem, and I will mention it again on Monday. So as you well know, most of you have your heart on the left side. Oops, about 1 in 10,000 doesn't. Quite a shock when they go to the doctor. Everything is inverted. Okay, and a lot of your internal organs are thing. There are also genetic disorders like Cartagena's syndrome and so forth, in which it becomes randomized. So the question is, how can you get this reliable molecular global asymmetry? I will show you our model on Monday, because I think it's molecularly based. But you should just know that we do know a little bit about it. We don't know the basic mechanism, but that early on, once again in this organizer region, we know that on the right-hand side, one particular activin gene is activated. It activates this receptor, which blocks Sonic Hedgehog on the right side. Sonic Hedgehog comes on the left side. It turns on Nodal, which and a very complicated cascade. Oh, 20, 30 genes, all the thing, and that's what determines the thing. However, if you say to me, could you please tell me why it is that activin comes on the right side and not on the left side? Complicated. There is one interesting model and an interesting set of experiments which I believe to be wrong. Not the experiments. But you find in this node region here little cilia, tiny little cellular structures which move, wave. And there is evidence which that the movement of those cilia set up a current from one side to the other, a water current from one side to the other, and that is the basic of the asymmetry. I don't believe it.
Well, so then the question is, who's one step further? Why do the cilia...
Oh, no, that's all right. That's not too hard. Yeah. I can tell you that cilia anyhow, how the cilia become oriented, that is taken as given. If you go to a frog, a tadpole, and look at the cilia on there, they're all organized. There's no question that cilia can become organized. And it's related to the molecular structure, and they are oriented along the anteroposterior and dorsoventral axes. How they do that, but there's certainly well-defined asymmetry in cilia. But the question is it the movement of the cilia? That is probably the standard view at the moment. We don't agree with it. And we could talk for Ed.
Is there any problem for people with organs in survival?
No, well, it depends what happens. If you get it completely reversed, you're absolutely fine.
So then there should be a 50% chance that it could be either a left person or a right person.
Oh, no. Oh, no, 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 hold on a second. No, no. If it happens by chance, or we don't know what, or something happens, and you can be normal, but evolution has chosen to put the heart on the left side. It has biased it. So, and in those cases where it goes wrong, most heart abnormalities are related to the fact that the symmetry hasn't worked properly.
What if a left-hearted person mates with a right-hearted person?
Yes, I'm sure they would. There's no one's ever identified. Well, I can tell you about, this is not the moment to go into it, but I'm not sure with the inf mouse. What happens with an inf mouse with a normal mouse? I think it could be 50-50. Let's get involved in this.
So there's a concept of dominance and recessive.
So oh, yes. No, but with mice, don't let's get into left-right. It's a whole area all on its own. Just know there are genes that affect it. And mice are quite interested. Please, did you want to ask? No. Maybe just wait. Okay. I'm just trying to tell you what's around. Oh, what's that doing there? Oh, that's to tell me. Well, sorry, this is the way you develop. And this is what Michelle and I work on. This is forming that streak region. There's that organizing region. Cells move through this furrow here and give rise to the muscles, the cartilage, and also the cells of the gut. How that straight line is specified is what I spend all my time thinking about, but I'm not going to tell you. Right. We're going to get rid of this one and now move. Now I've got to get, sorry, one second. I'm going to show you I'm clever. End show. And slideshow, view show. So it's my next lot. Good. Oh. Hold on. Something's gone wrong, children. End show, it's the one behind, that's what I mean. Where are you? There we are, morphogenesis. Slideshow, I'm pretending. Good. Because what I want to move on to a little bit now is a little bit about change in shape. You know, there are all these genes and these signals, but, you know, it's morphology. I'm a civil engineer. So it's the mechanics of development I've spent a lot of my life thinking about. And the formation of that streak is a problem in mechanics. And just to recognize that the way cells divide can be quite complex. So this is a simple radial cleavage. The cell divides like this. The nematode is an unequal cleavage, the first cleavage, quite a thing. And in mollusks and things, you get spiral cleavage. And we know a little bit about the mechanisms involved. And certainly the cytoskeleton is absolutely at the core of this. So you can get quite complex patterns of cleavage, quite complex. You can get radial cleavage, you can get asymmetrical cleavage, you can get spiral cleavage. You look puzzled.
Now what's spiral about?
They actually form a spiral.
But then later on?
They'll give rise to a snail.
But later on?
And
the first row, there's nothing spiral about it?
No, the first, well, the first the slight asymmetry here, but the next lot won't be, you know, like that. It will be slightly twisted, as you can see here, and it forms more and more spiral. What the significance of that is to the animal is quite complicated, but these animals will make a spiral shell. And it is related to the spirality of the cell, which way the spiral goes. First thing I want to tell you is about cell adhesion. Cells stick to each other. I think it's less important than we used to think. Because I think signaling between cells is more important, but there are classical experiments. I think Holtfretter was at Rutgers, actually. Was he? You don't know even. They're very, very famous embryologist. If you take the cells of an early embryo that are going to give rise to the skin and fuse them with those that are going to give rise to the gut, just a nice, you know, in the laboratory experiment, they will completely separate. They will stick together a little bit, but then they will separate out. So there are different cell adhesion molecules which can determine cell behavior. I think they play less of a role than we used to think, and more signaling between cells is probably more important. Nevertheless, from a mechanical point of view, that's important.
What organism is
that? That's frog. Here's the engineer's dream. This is contraction. This is really what makes you look what you like on the whole. And it's contractile proteins that contract that really bring about shape changes in development. So first of all, in the cleaving cell is a contractile ring, but one of the two more important from the point of view of development is what is known as apical constriction, which constricts here and converts this cell into this wedge-like form. And that's absolutely fundamental in many things, as I'll show you in relation to curvature. And then, of course, there's the migrating cell. We don't really know how cells move. I mean, once again, one could give six lectures on it. But basically, they put out phylopodia and pull. Okay. So I always say the way to think about cell movement, imagine you're in the sea and there are rocks and you search around to where you get the best grip and then pull yourself out. That's what determines where cells are. Where cells go and how they move.
I just make sure I follow. This transparency you're talking about, individual cells.
Individual cells.
The previous one in which you
talked. Oh, I'm going to show you that. Yes,
there were many, many cells.
Oh, sure, but only some of them will contract, as I'll show you.
Physicists like numbers. What kind of numbers are you about when you're doing
in the forces?
Yeah, not adhesion. How many cells?
Oh.
Millions of cells?
Remember, the rule about development. Everything is initially on a small scale. Things get big by growth. Remember, your hand, big beast as it is, was this big when it was laid down. And in all of these, it's always small.
Right, but in the transparency when you had better.
I'm coming to it. Here's just a very simple old model of mine. You see, here, quite easy to get something like this. In fact, the way the sea urchin does that is to get a shape like this, is that every time the cells divide, the cleavage plane is this way. Do you understand? They always so it's simply the blastocele gets bigger and bigger when it divides. Okay? So that's one way. In other words, controlling the early plane of cleavage will determine the form of the embryo. And we've shown these cells round up, and they always cleave this way, and that's why the shape. If then adhesion increases, they'll take on a shape like that. If, on the other hand, we have more cleavage like that, it will simply get bigger and keep a single layer. And that's exactly the way it develops, the early sea urchin. So very simple things like this bring about changes in shape. But this is the one that you wanted to know. So you have the apical thing here. Some of the cells get involved. Yes, there'll be a few hundred cells involved. I would never say thousands. And this, you get a change in curvature. And you can see this very nicely, although I'm lying now. This is how your neural tube, your brain, develops. Not entirely. It starts off as a flat sheet in this region here, and then these begin to fold over. And partly it may be localized contraction over here, and then there are hinge points. But effectively, to be blunt, we don't have a good model for neural tube formation, but I'm pretty sure it involves that mechanism. There may be some pushing from the outside here, then they fuse and this comes off, and that's what gives rise to the brain. And from the earlier slide, it's the cells down here that will give rise to the motor neurons. It's that transverse section that you asked about.
The fusing and the splitting, that's understood?
Yes, it is. Oh, sure. Just let me go back. Oh, we know that the reason why these two fuses, they have different cell adhesion molecules to this one here.
And a cell membrane, the stuff that forms a cell membrane just disappears?
No. These cells fuse and some of the cells move inside. These are the cells, in fact, that move inside, are the cells that will give rise to your face and all your sensory nerves. But I don't want to get into the neural crest as a... It's an amazing thing. No, when I say fuse, I mean the two layers fuse and these separate off because the adhesion molecules here are of a different class to those there.
Is it dorsal ventral gradient that's driving expression of special adhesion molecules?
Yes, absolutely. Well, it's neural induction. It's complex, yes, but effectively that, yes. Well, and now I want to get into gastrulation, and remember from the beginning I told you, which you've forgotten, that what gastrulation is about is the cells that are going to give rise to the guts and your muscles and everything on the inside are initially on the outside of the embryo and they've got to get in. And a nice model is the sea urchin, which I used to work on, And here is what the blastula, it is a single layer because remember all the planes of cleavage were radial, and so they none moved inside. And this is going to be the future mesoderm, that is the muscles and so forth, and this is going to be the gut. And what happens, these cells move inside, and they're called the primary mesenchyme. I'm going to talk about their migration a little later on. And now we begin to get the gut forming, and it begins to move in. The mechanics of that is not all that simple. It's certainly there are localized contractions in this region here which folds it. So it's in two phases. It begins to go in a little way, and then these cells at the tip begin to put out long processes, and we've got wonderful films of this, in which they attach and pull the gut in. And so here it's been pulled up here, and then it's pulled to the side, and then it meets this region here, and it's fusion again. Cell fusion, not thing done, and now you have the anus, and that's the mouth.
In the first two pictures,
yes, yeah,
the gray area, the shaded area inside.
That's just hollow space. That's just hollow space.
I'm not filled with anything.
No, I wouldn't like to say. I don't think the sea urchin would like to say it's not filled with. It's called the blastocele. Yes.
So then it reaches out with these filaments.
Yes, phylopodia.
Which side goes to?
No, random. Random.
Side? Random.
Random, but because they adhere better to this side, when they get up here, they've got a choice of which way to go, and they stick better here.
I suppose
it's random protrusion. So I'm saying it's like getting out of the rocks. Mm-hmm. You search, and where you get the best grip, that's right. Where you come.
Now, what? The same thing, more or less. The same picture applies to humans,
no.
More or less. No.
Alas, more complicated. But the basic principles, I'd like to say, are the same. And here's a model that George Oster made millions of years ago, in which he simply modeled this with a propagated apical constriction. And he got something very much like a early phase of sea urchin gastrulation. So here's a propagated, it's apical constriction being propagated. It's spreading. Are you with me? Yes. That's quite a simple model. And I think that's probably on the right lines. And as it's going in, at one stage it's a bit more complicated because there's a mechanism called convergent extension in which these cells which are coming in not only are pulled in but tend to converge and extend. I'm going to show it to you. I'm not sure if I have it on the next slide or not. No, I don't, but I'll show it to you later. And this is what it looks like in the insect. These cells have moved in from here, that's the mesoderm, and that's shown in the next slide. It just looks just like the sea urchin, actually. You've got apical constriction here. This is a transverse section of the insect embryo. And here, these cells are undergoing apical constriction, and this is the mesoderm going in. The trouble is, we don't know what signals there are from these cells. Twist and snail are expressed there. We don't know what makes them constrict in that region. Now, just to show you, and I'm going to be very brief, that looked all nice and simple with the sea urchin. If you go to the frog, this is how the frog gastrulates. There's a hollow blastocele, and then things move. I'm not going to teach you. It's too hard. It's monstrously complicated. And thing in the lip here, just have a look in this lip here. These cells begin to move in here, and they follow. It's complicated. But you can get a feel of what's going on by looking here. Now, I think the next one's better. Just think what happens. So this is looking at the belly of the frog. And this is before gastrulation. And just look, here are two points around the side here, okay? You see where C and D are? Look where C and D end up in the larva. Next to each other. So these two points, right on opposite sides, have got to come together. And we have a look at this point, A and B. They're quite close together. And where is A? A now is going to end up right at the top and B right at the bottom. So there are very, very dramatic changes in shape. So C and D will end up next to each other. A and B will separate. So B is going to go all the way up there and C and D are going to come in. It's a tricky and complex process, and it's shown here. Effectively, it's the same thing here, that this moves up and these move together. So you can see A and B are separating, extending, and these are converging. And this is what is known as convergent extension. I spend my life thinking about it, The world authority is Ray Keller in Virginia, and I must fan him. And the core of it is this mechanism. You start off with cells like this. They take on this particular shape, and then they move together like this, and therefore converge and extend. I can understand that to there. I cannot understand that to there. I claim cells cannot do it without being pulled. I just don't understand it. It's a serious problem, and I don't know anybody who understands it. But it happens, I'm afraid, in your guest relation. Convergent extension is partly why you're here. Oh, and that's the Henson's node again, I told you about. And just a quick word about the cell migration. Those cells that move in here, they move in and they've got lovely long phylopodia. They move around and they stay at the bottom and they form a very beautiful circle. And effectively, all they're doing is exploring the wall of the blastocoel, and which specifies where they shall go. And that's not very controversial. Just a little word about neurons and their migration. This is what a neuron looks like. Millions of phylopodia, and they're exploring like mad. And the way they find their way is by all sorts of things. Certain chemicals called nephrons attract neurons by chemotaxis, so the cell will move towards this. There's chemorepulsions, semaphorins, they'll move away from it. There's cadherins, which if there's a gradient, they'll move up it. And there's contact repulsion, that if sometimes they meet efferents, they won't migrate along it. So there are lots of ways of controlling how the cells move. And this is very important because, for example, this is in the frog, the retinotectal connections, there are very precise connections between the retina and the tectum. And how those set up, I'm trying to arrange, get, I think Lemke, there's a chap from the Salk who's got wonderful work on this, who I'm hoping will come up the beginning of next month to talk about it. It's all involving cell. I'm not going to tell you about it. It's beautiful stuff.
Well, that's
to do with neurophysiology. That when you see something in your right eye, then you want your left hand to come across. You know, I'm not a neurophysiologist, but you do see it. It goes to both sides, by the way. But the dominant thing is across, and partly of the patterning is concerned is that there are various molecules called efferents and cells from the retina. These ones, those that are low in efferin A3, will go to a site where it's high in efferin A2, and that's what Lemke will come and talk to us.
What is the tectum that's part of our brain?
Sure. Uh-huh. That's the visual tectum. That's where the nerve cells from the retina end up. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm coming almost to the end, I'm glad to say. Just a tiny word about growth. Because growth, as I keep telling you, everything is laid down small. But just before I get to big growth, let me tell you a little bit about small growth. Something we're going to talk about next Tuesday. This is an old experiment. First of all, it reminds you about compartments. If you, there are clever techniques. I think I'll show it in the next slide, actually. Just believe me, there are clever genetic techniques for creating a clone, a single cell in the fly with a unique genetic constitution. Just believe me. I don't want to take you into genetics. Just believe, by fancy irradiation and things, you can get a very small region or a very few cells, in fact, one cell with a unique genetic constitution. Now, what has been found is that if you mark cells, and you can get them colored, if they're in this anterior compartment, they will never cross this boundary. You'll never find a clone of cells, because they come from a single cell, on both sides of the boundary, unless those genes that maintain the boundary are there. But the other important thing is this. You can make the wing in a fly in which all the cells grow very slowly. They'll make a perfectly sensible fly, but the cells grow slowly. But what you can do is you can, by this technique, make one cell that's normal. it will outcompete all the other cells and completely fill this. Completely and utterly fill it. So the cells do compete. In other words, they don't care how many divisions. They're not counting divisions, anything. They're just filling, doing the right thing. If others are slow, they say, too bad, nothing for you. And that's that one. Outgrow. I think there is some evidence they actually compete too.
But what you describe is
just... And what I'm describing is outgrowing. But I think there is some evidence that they actually, in other systems, they actually compete. The way you grow, and if you remember, I got into an argument with your director at the last thing as to whether there was any influence between one limb and the other. And I can assure you, whatever a theoretical physicist may say, the answer is no. And the way your limbs grow, they're laid down about that big, grow for the next 16 years, and they're remarkably reliable. And the reason they're remarkably reliable is that there are many components. The way your bones grow is because they have, each bone has growth plates at the ends of it. And this is a typical, so what is this? This is a tibia thing. There's a growth plate here and a growth plate here. And what you see that in the growth plate, you have, first of all, you have cells dividing here, and then you have this long region here in which they mature. And it's because there are so many cells contributing to it that they average out any errors. It's because if there were a single layer of line of cells here, you'd be in real difficulty. I can't remember there's 100 or 30, but it's a lot. And that's why, almost certainly, you have reliability. So there's that. And it's also, incidentally, there are mechanisms of controlling. This is just quite amusing. Why are your muscles fit so nicely on your limb? Are they sort of programmed to grow at the same rate? No. The muscles attach to the bones, and when the bones grow, they pull on the muscles, and therefore they grow to the right length. And here's a little example that here's the normal development of a muscle. And here's one in which has been put in a plaster cast. It can't grow. You release them out of the plaster cast. The cartilage can pull on them, and they get back to normal. So the length of your muscles is determined by the pull on them, by the surrounding bones.
Does that have anything to do with the importance of exercising or no?
No. Well, on the whole, no. I don't think so. I'm talking about the embryo. And here's a nice example of a big salamander and a large salamander. You graft a limb from a big salamander onto a small salamander. It says, I don't give a hoot, I'm going to do my own thing, and it just grows bigger. I think that's almost there. Just worth noting, we haven't spoken about cell death. Cell death is really in fashion at the moment. It plays a very important role in many situations in modeling the embryo. And a very remarkable example in your own development, because this is a mammalian embryo, at a very early stage there's a region here which has to be hollowed out. And the way it's hollowed out is by cells dying, and they get particular structures to die. I just have to remind you that every one of your cells has a suicide program. Hopefully those that become cancerous, the suicide program is activated, and therefore you are saved. What you wouldn't like is all your cells to be activated, because you'd simply turn into dead cells. So, the last one is, and it's just worth remembering, that ontogeny does not recapitulate phylogeny. Oh no, and there's not quite the last one here. A tiny bit on evolution. There's a famous statement by Ernst Haeckel, who said the development, what the phases you went through in development, recapitulated ancestral forms. Now, just let me tell you, in your development and in all vertebrates, there's a phase in which you have gill slits in the embryo. And he said, you're recapitulating a fish ancestor. No. What you're recapitulating is the embryonic stage. The embryonic stage of your ancestor, which evolution tinkers with. Evolution, as Francois Jacob pointed out, is a tinkerer. It rarely invents anything. It fiddles with what is there. And I'm going to show you some examples. What's the origin of jaws? Well, there were gill slits in these fish, and there were bony things supporting them, and these became modified to give you the jaws. All right, you say, I don't believe it, but honestly, the evidence for that is pretty good. Just have a look what's happened to gill slits. When you're an embryo, and this is human now, when you're an embryo, there are these slits, these arches. And just look what they give rise to. They give rise to the malleus, incis, and stapes of the inner ear. They give rise to bits of Meckel's cartilage. It's become modified in evolution. And the most dramatic example for me is this one. We have to look where the incus comes from. You know you have three little bones in your middle ear. Even physicists know that. Yes. Okay. Malleus and incus and strap. And where did the malleus, where did the incus come from? This one here. In your ancestors, the incus was this bone in the jaw of on the upper jaw of a reptile. When these became changes, and here it is. Looks slightly wrong, actually, the way I've drawn it there. That doesn't look right. Anyhow, here's the quadrate. It was this quadrate here. And when this was no longer necessary here, this then became the incus. And this articular one here became the malleus. It's amazing. And the question was, what about the intermediate forms? Oh, the embryology and the paleontology is unequivocal. Unequivocal. Now, don't you shrug. The one thing I'm prepared to go to the grave for is the correctness of this. And why? What happened, you see, is in the lower jaw here, this became, you've got a single bone in your lower jaw. So because it's stronger, when this was thing, this had nothing to do. And evolution said, I'll tell you what I'll do, is I'll use it as a third bone for the middle ear. Now, the bloody trouble is, I do agree with you, the intermediate forms, it's simply, for me, that is one of the most beautiful examples I know of evolution. Absolutely amazing.
When we say that we know that this
yes.
is the equivalent to that,
yes.
Now, what you mean to say is that at some point, at the very beginning in the embryo, there's just a particular position in there, which is the same in both. I mean, what do you mean by saying that they're that
yeah,
we can be out and they're the same?
That's a whole question of homology, which is a whole meeting on itself. I just go on morphological criteria. I'm ashamed to say I don't know enough about the face to know whether the same genes are expressed in the reptile as they are there. But I would say that you can just go on morphological criteria as to where it is in the embryo and how it develops.
Okay.
But I'm ashamed to say I don't know about that one. All right, I think that's my last slide. It is. It is. Well, that's enough. So just remember, evolution's amazing. It tinkers to remarkable effect. And I will, on Monday, tell you what problems are left for physicists. There you are.